Welcome back to the Hydrogen Bar podcast. Welcome back to your favorite podcast on hydrogen and fuel cells. We once again want to welcome you for a very interesting and exciting interview that we will do today. And of course, I want to welcome my partner Johannes. Hello, Johannes. Nice that you have made it.
Yeah, hello, Martin. I had some issues with the VPN again here in China. But yeah, finally, we could solve this. And we are very, very happy to welcome also our and guest to our bar again. This time, Thierry Leperc is joining us here. Welcome, Thierry.
Thank you, Johannes.
Yeah, it is a pleasure for us to have you here because you are really an expert in, also a veteran in this whole topic of renewable energies and turning the world carbon free, and have also now intensive experience in the hydrogen field. Therefore, we are really glad that you could make it here.
It's a pleasure.
Would you be so kind of introduce yourself in a couple of sentences? Because I guess most of our listeners might not know you perfectly. So it would be nice, I guess, if you could just introduce yourself.
Okay. My name is Thierry Leperc. I'm founder of DH2 Energy, which is a mass scale developer of hydrogen projects. And prior to that, I've started several companies in the renewable energy field. And the first one was Solar Direct, a company which was founded 15 years ago with a very clear vision to make solar power competitive. Company built 3 gigawatts of projects around the planet. Was a leader in reaching very, very low prices across Europe, Asia, the Americas, and Africa. And the company was sold to ENGIE, the very large energy company, in 2015. Yeah. And then I joined the executive committee of ENGIE, where I built technology platforms, including in hydrogen. And hydrogen seen as the continuation of solar, hydrogen seen as the cornerstone of 100% renewable system. And this is what we worked on at ENGIE. And then I left ENGIE 2.5 years ago when I thought things were not moving as fast as they should be. Now I'm an entrepreneur and doing mass-scale competitive green hydrogen projects.
Okay, I see. What was the problem that you identified with ENGIE? You said that things were not moving as fast as you imagined, maybe?
It's a typical thing in large corporations. I mean, no offense. ENGIE is a great company, yeah. And I very much appreciated the time I spent there. When you're talking about something just as revolutionary as replacing oil and gas, because that's what we're talking about, and that you happen to be in an oil and gas company, that obviously comes with some issues. So yeah. That's the reason why entrepreneurs are sometimes best suited to the projects on their own.
Yeah, I see. Right.
Mm-hmm. So you discovered the topic of hydrogen basically already inside ENGIE and drove it there, and then basically took it kind of under your own arms into the world, right?
Actually, it started before. 20 years ago, I started a think tank on energy with EDF, Gaz de France, Suez, and Café des Pots, and many startups. And we identified hydrogen back then as with having a huge potential. Now, obviously, that was not exactly the right timing then, because hydrogen was seen as mostly derived from natural gas, which was obviously not very interesting. If you're doing the same thing as natural gas, from natural gas at a price which is higher than natural gas, there's not much to be done. What has changed, and this is the work that we did at ENGIE Fab, this organization we set up within ENGIE and located next to Google's offices in central Paris, was something very simple. How do you have a 24/7 system based on renewables? It's a very simple question. And when I mean system, it's not just the electricity system. Electricity is just 20% of energy uses. But how do you have a system, an energy system that provides, that solves the trilemma? It's very important for everyone to understand what energy is about. Energy is summarized by the trilemma. Trilemma means energy security. That's the first thing that you want from an energy system. 24/7 fully dispatchable energy supply, whether that's for power, but also for heat, yeah, for industrial uses and everything. The second thing that you want from an energy system is competitiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And the third thing, some might argue it's the most important thing, it is decarbonization. Mm-hmm. That is the three things that you need to put together. And when we were at NG Fab, we designed a system with technology breaks, and then we came to the very simple conclusion. No such system will ever work without hydrogen as a cornerstone.
I see, right. You mentioned competitiveness, which is, of course, always a subject that we need to talk about when we talk about hydrogen. So normally you'd hear in discussions or in panels or conferences that hydrogen is quite expensive and that there is a long way to go and things like these. How can we make sure that hydrogen, or especially green hydrogen, will be competitive? What is the measures that we need to take to make this happen?
The first thing to understand is that there is no hydrogen if it's not competitive. Mm-hmm. Right now, you have a lot of talk, a lot of government initiatives on what I would call the climate hydrogen. Climate hydrogen is something where government policies set objectives and put together incentive schemes for projects to come about. That's mm-hmm. that's the way it's been done so far. The problem with that is that it won't get you anywhere. Why? Because we have the issue of volumes.
Mm-hmm.
And the other hydrogen I'm talking about here is hydrogen as a commodity, mass scale commodity. Now, I spent a lot of time with oil and gas people, and the first thing they tell you about when it comes to oil, they're saying we are 100 million barrels per day industry. Now imagine if somebody was coming and say, hey, you know what? I have a better form of oil. I'm just going to ask for $10 per barrel of subsidies.
Mm.
And that would cost $10 trillion over a 20-year period of subsidies. That will not work. I mean, this idea that you're going to have mass scale subsidization of hydrogen means that hydrogen cannot play its role. So mm-hmm. it's not, it should be, or it would be nice that for it to be competitive, that it will not exist at all, and we will not be able to decarbonize our economies until hydrogen is fully competitive.
I
now,
see.
Some people are saying, let's wait for 10, 20 years, or mm-hmm. And it will happen, and others, and I'm one of them, think that the time has come and it's hydrogen is competitive. Now, obviously, I'm talking green hydrogen.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So how do we get green hydrogen to be competitive? I mean, we hear all the time that it doesn't work without subsidies and so on. But basically, what I hear from you is that it's basically possible today already.
Well, that again, it's a
very
binary
near
question.
Future, let's put it
yeah.
this way.
If it's not possible, let's go to Mars. That's some people are suggesting that's an option. Let's plan a trip to Mars. Now if we're saying we need to solve the problem of competitiveness, to say what is competitiveness, and you have to start with a market, and that's called a very simple approach. That's called design to cost. You need to achieve something, and then you say, what is what I need to achieve, and how can I achieve it? And if the answer is I cannot achieve it, then you start crying and you start, or you do something else. Okay, what is the market price that we need to reach? And it's very, very simple. If you ask steel makers, if you ask ammonia producers, if you ask power producers, all of them tell you one thing. They're ready to buy hydrogen at 1.5 euro per kilo.
Mm-hmm.
And why that 1.5? It's roughly 1 euro per kilogram, which is the value of natural gas, or the equivalent of energy of natural gas delivered in Europe,
and
0.5, which is a carbon value based on the current ETS valuations, which is roughly 50 euros per ton of CO2. That is a very simple thing. It's binary. It's like, you know, oil. If you're saying, I have a wonderful oil well that produces oil at $100 a barrel, you won't sell one barrel. That's for sure. Now, 1.5, how do you get there? And that's the fundamental question. And I can run through you through a very, very basic economics. If you want to deliver the product 1.5, you need to produce it at 1.2 euros per kilogram, which means one thing very simply is that the so-called blue hydrogen from natural gas cannot work. Because if you add the cost of natural gas, the cost of SMR, steam methane reforming, and add to that CCS, which, by the way, is certainly not 100% proof when it comes to carbon emissions, you are far above that level. So it's not like, I don't like the color blue. I personally like it very much, but it just doesn't work. So green hydrogen is the way to go. Green hydrogen, and then 1.2 euro per kilogram, how do you get there? That's 30 euros per megawatt hour. That means something very simple. If you have power costs, the overall power cost, including the cost of transmission, that is above 15 euros per megawatt hour, it will not work. It will not work in 100 years.
Yeah. So you mentioned that the future will be a green hydrogen and that a blue hydrogen will not be the long-term solution, obviously. Or that's what you just said. On the other hand, of course, it's clear that we might need to start with a blue hydrogen or at least a certain share of blue hydrogen because we simply are not able to ramp up the production of green hydrogen fast enough. Is that the case or do you have another impression or picture there?
The most important thing to understand when it gets to hydrogen as a commodity, which is the definition that should be understood. Mm-hmm. As a commodity means large customers willing to pay a given price for very large volumes. And that price, and this is very important to understand, that price is 1.5 euros per kilogram, because that's the combination of the value of natural gas, which is the energy value of hydrogen compared to natural gas, which is roughly 1 euro per kilogram, and that 0.5 euro per kilogram, that is the carbon value if you make it equivalent to 50 euros per ton of CO2. Which means that if you take the issue of transmission and storage out, because that's important, that's if you want to look at the production cost, you have to take out the cost of transmission and storage, which will only come with pipes, by the way, with very large pipes and underground storage. We're talking about here a reaching a level of production cost of 1.2 euros per kilogram. That will not happen with natural gas ever. So that means something that's very simple. Blue hydrogen will never be competitive. Never. That's a very strong thing that people have to understand. If you take the cost of natural gas, the cost of steam methane reforming, and the cost of CCS, you are way above 1.8 euros per kilogram. So you're 50% more expensive than where you should be. No one will buy blue hydrogen. That's something that is very simple to understand.
So you're saying that also when we consider that maybe the production of blue hydrogen will scale up and will be operated in very, very large scales, it will not be able to compete with a green hydrogen.
It's not to compete with green hydrogen. It will not find any customer.
Right. Okay.
And then the question is, can green hydrogen do the job or not? And what we have today is a very simple question. Can we produce hydrogen at 1.2 euros per kilogram and how? And if you want to produce it from power, you need power at a maximum price of 15 euros per megawatt hour. And that means several things. That means that green hydrogen from electrolysis coming from the power grid cannot work and will not even work in the next 100 years. Why? Because the cost of the power grid is actually close to that 15 euros per megawatt hour. So that cannot work. So the only way you can have a system that works, and this is why it's so important to start from the market, is when you have the joint location of renewables on the one side and electrolyzers connected not to the power grid, which is outrageously expensive, but to the gas grid. And this is fundamental. Anybody that doesn't look at this from a cost basis is just going in the wrong direction. And where do you get that 15 euros per megawatt hour renewables? Well, it's very tough to get it from wind. Certainly not in Europe. You can get it maybe in some parts of the US or where you get reach those levels, but it's very, very tough. In Europe, it's only solar. And solar in just two countries where it's already been matched, and it's Spain and Portugal, which means that we have to realize that no production of hydrogen will ever happen in Germany, in France, in Italy. This is the power, the sheer power of numbers. You know, it's like bananas. You don't produce bananas in France or Germany. You could, we could, but they're better produced somewhere else.
Yeah. Now, these 15 euros per megawatt hour is really a value that we see today, right? Would this then mean that we can use this together with the electrolyzers of today to reach this, this competitive price? Or do you assume then that there is further advances in the electrolyzers necessary to get competitive?
50 euros is indeed a level which has been reached in tenders, solar tenders in Spain, Portugal, and in the Gulf region. So it's already there. Now, the good news about solar is that prices are still sinking. You've probably seen a tender which was allocated at $10 per megawatt hour in Saudi Arabia just a couple of weeks ago. So, and the threshold of $10 is going to be crossed soon. So we have the immense power of solar PV technology, where costs are, where efficiencies are moving up, or cell efficiencies are really going up very fast. It's still not a stable technology by far. It is improving on a daily basis, and it's moving very fast. So its costs are set to go down and down in the next 5 to 10 years. Likewise, so that's a very, very strong thing to start from. Now, the obvious question then is electrolyzers. Now, if you're doing electrolyzers, I'd say by hand, which is what lots of people are still doing today, it just won't work. So you need those so-called gigafactories of electrolyzers. Now, the good news is that a number of today mostly European electrolyzer manufacturers are set to do that. You know, Nel, ITM, McPhee. In Germany, you also have ThyssenKrupp and several others, who are moving into the gigafactory paradigm. And gigafactories mean both efficiencies of scale, is also bigger stacks. This is another thing, evolution of technologies. We have bigger stacks. So overall, you can expect prices for electrolyzers to sink by a factor of at least 60% in the next 5 years, owing to this gigafactory paradigm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I see. So we've recently talked on the podcast about some very interesting projects in the Netherlands, which combine wind power and electrolysis, maybe even offshore electrolyzers, and then aim for transporting the hydrogen gas via the pipeline network, for especially here to Germany. Now, you just said that wind power here in Europe might not be the most cost-effective solution when producing hydrogen. So you think then that these projects that are set up, for example, in the Netherlands and also in the Baltic Sea, I think there is some considerations for such projects, are not very reasonable, and we should focus on photovoltaic power from Spain and Portugal?
Let's take an example. We're right now working with steel companies, and we have a steel company that has a steel mill in Hamburg.
Mm-hmm.
They need 130,000 tons of hydrogen to replace coking coal through direct reduced iron technology.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is that if they don't want to be out of business, they cannot pay that hydrogen at 1.5 or slightly above 1.5. It's roughly 1.5 euro per kilogram.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is that if you start with, if you have hydrogen from offshore wind, you will never, ever be able to deliver the given hydrogen below 3 euros. That's twice the price which they want. Which means that for that given plant, you need a 1.5 euro per kilogram subsidy, which over a period of 20 years is 4 billion euros of subsidies. Now, who in their right mind is going to say, I need 4 billion euros of subsidies for one plant? Now, imagine you have 100 plants like that, and you're saying now it's 400 billion. Now, I know that Germany is a rich country.
Yeah,
400 billion? That's a lot of money. I mean, who's going to pay for that?
Yeah.
And I think the experience of the EEG, et cetera, and people say, oh, we should do like the EEG, except, you know, 100 times bigger. Mm-hmm. You know what? It won't happen.
Now, when we look at this, the price decrease in the electrolyzers, what do you think is a reasonable time frame that this will be achievable?
You have the combination of two things. You have first technology changes. You know, for instance, in alkaline technologies, you have the size of stacks. We're talking about stacks moving from 1 megawatt to 5, and in some instances, 10 megawatt stacks, which reduce the cost and also improve the efficiency of the electrolyzers. And then you have this gigafactories. Now, what is interesting, by the way, in electrolyzers is that it is it's not hugely capital intensive. It's mostly an assembly work. So what is key here is to have the value chain work together. So you need to have coatings. You need to have power electronics. You need to have electrodes. And all this value chain needs to be ramped up, just like wind technology when industry was ramped up. So what you need is a ramp up. What we're seeing today, and the experience of solar is a great indication. If you look at the situation of solar, the average size of a solar cell factory back in 2005 was roughly 50 megawatts.
Mm-hmm.
And within 5 years, it had moved to 500 megawatts, 10 times bigger. And now, obviously, it's even 10 times bigger. So what you can see is that in a fairly short amount of time, you can have a scaling up. Now you have issues of the risks attached to that wrapping up.
Mm-hmm.
But the experience shows that in similar technologies, which are rather modular, and this is very important here, we're not talking about disruptive technology changes. We're talking mm-hmm. about ramping up. So it's more mostly an issue of industrial organization. And what we have today is European firms showing the lead. I'm going to tell you something. I think that if Europe doesn't go to 10, 20, 50 gigawatt of annual electrolyzer capacity soon, China will do it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, when you say that we need to produce hydrogen via solar power in Spain and Portugal, of course, the produced hydrogen will finally have to be transported to, for example, France or Germany. And of course, there are plans to utilize the existing natural gas pipeline network for this. When we are talking about using the pipeline network, of course, there's always the question on how pure will the hydrogen be when it reaches its target. And of course, when we use really old natural gas pipelines, we might end up with a pretty, yeah, like dirty hydrogen in the end. And so also, of course, the issue of purification is a thing that we need to talk about. Would you say that purification technology is already well enough established to make sure that we can use the hydrogen at a very high purity level in France or in Germany?
I mean, the purity question is not the same for all usage. I mean, if you're looking at the situation, for instance, of steel or people who want to burn hydrogen, mm-hmm. I mean, the fact
yeah, of course
that pure is not our problem.
Yeah.
If you want to use it for in the semiconductor industry or other things, might be an issue.
Or even mobility, well, actually. So when you want to use it for fuel cells, then
absolutely
then
fuel
it has
cells.
To be very pure.
Yeah. But then again, fuel cells. People equate hydrogen with fuel cells. As it happens, and then again, let's take mobility outside for one second. But industrial uses will represent the vast majority of uses in of hydrogen for the next, at least 10 years.
Yeah.
Now. Obviously, for other uses, and you're rightly pointing, and there is a very strong potential, by the way, for especially trucking, mm-hmm. the trucking industry, and obviously, in this case, it's fuel cells and really pure, purification technologies exist, and they work quite well. They add a cost. I mean, it's basically a cost issue, but that can. There's no reason why it should be a fundamental technical obstacle. Purifying gases is not, there again, rocket science.
One point that we might need to consider is the cost for this purification and transport. Or do you think this will be in pipelines so minor that it doesn't make a big difference anymore?
We have to think of hydrogen as the new natural gas, the new oil. And 60 years ago, when Germany moved to natural gas with imports from the then Soviet Union, it changed its infrastructure based on that product that came from now Russia. And that was instrumental, by the way, for a boom of the German economy in the following decades. Mm-hmm. We are right now in the same situation with one advantage, is that the infrastructures exist. 50 years ago, you had to build the the pipelines between Siberia and Germany. Today, you don't. These infrastructures exist. Mm-hmm. You have tens of thousands of kilometers which are being readied to be transformed with the so-called European Hydrogen Backbone Initiative, which now brings together 23 gas TSOs around Europe and made a new announcement a couple of weeks ago regarding a plan of deploying 40,000+ kilometers of pipelines. So this is going to happen. Now, the question is how fast? But the issue here, which is very interesting, is that pipes can be fairly big. And when they're big, they're extremely efficient mm-hmm. in terms cost-wise. And you can transmit extremely big volumes. You know, on average, if you compare a natural gas pipes versus a high-voltage power line, because lots of people are talking about high-voltage power lines, it's a factor of 10. The kind of energy that can move. And when you get to the storage issue, when we're talking about storage capacity, the cost of storage in underground caverns is around 100%, 100 times less than batteries, and the capacity is 10,000 times more. So overall, we have a very, very efficient system now, which will need to be transformed, repurposed, expanded, but the basis for the infrastructure exists, and the gas TSOs who run most of it are extremely keen to make it happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much for today, Thierry. We've reached our time limit once again, so thank you very much for your time and for these very interesting insights, and we are very much looking forward to continuing this discussion next week. So we'd be happy if you could join us once again next week. For today, we want to say goodbye, not before we mention our website once again, which is hydrogenbar.net. You will also find a contact form on this website. So if you want to get in contact with us or even with Thierry, you can use the contact form and send us an email. And then we'll try to react as fast as possible. Please tune in for next week's episode once again. Thank you, Johannes. And thank you, Thierry, once again. Hear you next week and goodbye.